The rest of us are in Psalms 55. Psalms 55. All right. Psalm 55. Let's start reading a little earlier than we stopped last time. Just for context's sake, now the psalmist David is looking at, is approaching the subject here from the perspective of the wicked, and he's praying in what is called an imprecatory prayer, and that means he's praying down fire on his enemies. And we're not called to pray that way anymore. We're supposed to pray for our enemies, and so on. So. You probably shouldn't take the example of the psalmist in this particular case. But verse 15, 55:15, let death seize upon them and let them go down quick into hell, for wickedness is in their dwellings and among them. He's talking about the wicked. As for me, I will call upon God and the Lord shall save me. Evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. And that's a good practice if you have a chance. You know, if you don't have a lot of time to give in one particular portion of the day for for an hour of prayer or something like that, I mean, folks, everybody gets a 30-minute break for lunch or something like that. You can surely spend 2 or 3 minutes checking in with the Lord, amen? So evening, morning, and at noon will I pray and cry aloud. He shall hear my voice. He hath delivered my soul in peace from the battle that was against me, for there were many with me. Verse 19, God shall hear and afflict them, even he that abideth of old, Selah. He's probably talking about the second advent there. But he says, and this is where we closed last time, I might pick up here and just talk for just a minute. It says, because they, and that is the wicked, have no changes, therefore they fear not God. Now, we closed talking about those changes. In fact, we ran a couple of verses. But it's saying that one of the reasons that people continue sometimes without the fear of God and in their wickedness is that because nothing is happening in their lives to shake them up. And, when you get a death sentence from a doctor, then you have a tendency to, look at yourself a little more, When you're having family problems or a kid goes prodigal or something like that, even if you're a wicked person and in great comfort, you have a tendency to start looking inward a little bit. And that's what the psalmist is acknowledging. He says, because they have no changes, therefore they fear not God. Now, you hear political personages talking about change is good and, what we need is change and change and change. But really, that's a tool. And really, folks don't like change at all. You have your job and you have your health and you have your family and you have your routine and you have your TV and you have your hobbies and stuff. And when something comes along, what you really want is to continue doing it the way you want to do it. And when, the economy starts to kind of go bust or the stock market starts jumping around like a, like an earthquake or something like that, then folks start, getting a little shaky. Like I said, you're facing the music on getting a test back from the doctor or something like that, and it could be bad. It may not be, but it could be. If you don't have things going like that going on in your life, then you just kind of have a tendency to settle back your little hind end in a nice cozy place, and it's just good, And as long as you're left alone and your prosperity and your health and you have some money and everything's going good, then why fear God? Right? That's the way we are. I'm sorry, you're a sinner. That's the way you're wired. You were born that way, and in the main, that's how you are. That's just how we all are. It's human nature, sinful human nature. Now, when it comes to that, it's he says, because they have no changes, therefore they fear not God. So I'll tell you this, without too much fear that I'm going to be proven wrong, is that one of the things the Lord does on a fairly seasonal basis, it may not be all the time, maybe for some, It's more all the time than others. The Lord has a tendency to come along and shake your tree. And if not to change things, to at least threaten you with change. Now, just think about raising kids. You know, about the time you don't know what you're doing, so you have a baby, and about the time you figure out, you think you know what you're doing, the baby is then a crawler. And then about the time that you think you have it figured out, you know, what you should be doing, the baby becomes a toddler. And you go on up the sequence of things. You know, what I learned is that nobody is ever really in a comfortable place for long raising a kid, because the kid's always growing. It's always a place, at least for first-time parents, that you've never been before. And so, you know, the kid turns 8 and 9, and then one day the little boy or the little girl turns about 10 or 11, and then they're really different. And whatever you had figured out about child raising at that juncture in your life goes out the window, and you have to start all over. And from 11 on, it's one teenage crisis after another. And you just never, the Lord has the thing settled where you never settle in. And that's good. The Lord is interested in making sure that you don't get so comfortable and cozy that you have all the answers and that you don't need Him. So whether it be your job, which you may or may not like, you may even hate it. Part of the reason for some of that stuff is the fact that the Lord wants to keep you off balance enough so that you know you need Him. He wants to leave you exposed enough. I mean, if you're one of those folks that, you know, you're plainly not hurting too bad, you carry a little extra weight and stuff, so you're not going to starve to death. But as far, you know, you kind of live hand to mouth as far as your income's concerned, and you struggle at the end of the month, or the first of the month, to make the mortgage, and by the time you make the mortgage, by late in the month, you're beginning to squeeze the rest of the pennies to make sure that you can fit in under the wire at the end of the month. Okay, well, so you're always under the threat of not being able to make the bill. I mean, if the transmission goes one more time, I don't know what we're going to do, right? The Lord's in some of that stuff. Because, ladies and gentlemen, because they have no changes, therefore they fear not God. And if the Lord just leaves you alone in your prosperity and in your comfort and with your entertainment and nothing threatens from any quarter, before long you ain't even going to need to pray. And the Lord is not interested in cultivating that in you. He is going to plow the ground. And so whatever else is the case, I mean, I don't know from what quarter it comes for you on a seasonal basis, but most of us are left uncomfortable at some level or another, you know, an awful lot of the time. And the reason that's the case is because the Lord is interested in bringing about changes. I just had a coach one time, and he was the meanest dude in the world, Coach George. He got cut from, he was one of the last guys in camp as an offensive lineman in Chicago way back in the early 70s or something like that, and they cut him. He was one of the last cuts. That made him one of the meanest men that ever lived. Because, I mean, in high school, that guy was on me from the moment I stepped on the field till I went inside to go home. And what he told me one time after just reaming me out all day long was, if there ever comes a time that I quit giving you a hard time, it's because I've given up on you. So I remembered that. And I don't know that God is like Coach George, but it seems to kind of fit along those lines. He says, because they have no changes, because they're not threatened with change, therefore they fear not God. And you don't need less fear. You need more. No matter what contemporary Christianity says, you don't need less fear. I'm not talking about the fear of man. I'm not talking about the fear the world imparts. I'm talking about the fear of God. You don't need less. You need more. Verse 20. Now, at this juncture in the psalm, there's something that happens. It happens fairly regularly where the psalmist is talking about something or the prophet's talking about something, and then it kind of segues from something real practical into some real prophetic stuff that leads into deeper and deeper things. For instance, in verse 20, now he's talking generally about the wicked. He says in verse 20, he, the wicked hath put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant. Then he says, the words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. Now, what he edged into there in verse 20, leading up to somebody who's a flatterer, who comes in and obtains the kingdom by flattery, the words of his mouth are smoother than butter. He's talking about, prophetically, he's talking about the Antichrist in verse 20. He hath put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant. Now go with me for a minute. We're going to build up to something, but it's been a while since we kind of went through some of this. Look in Daniel chapter 11, if you would. And my intent is to show you that, once again, your Bible is a multi-layered production that God wrote. God published it. And the God who knows all things and sees all things and is a wordsmith on top lays truth upon truth. And sometimes he overlays and intertwines historic truth with doctrinal truth, with prophetic truth, and then mixed in there as well as practical stuff. And that's what he's done in Daniel chapter 11. He keeps talking about this guy who breaks this covenant. He's a wicked person in verse 20. He has put forth his hands against such as be at peace with him. He hath broken his covenant. Now, we'll start, and this is kind of just a survey thing. Look in Daniel chapter 11. And once again, the Lord does that in this passage, at least as far as I can see. There's a lot of this passage that, you know, I have a hard time getting a grip in as far as figuring out exactly who he's talking about and when he's talking about them. Nevertheless, by the time you get down to verse 18 or so, things start to change, and the rest of this passage is something that's easily understood if you know the Bible. For instance, verse 18, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. And then it really starts. Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes. Now, I don't think it's Joe Biden, okay? But it does show a tendency. One of the things that's going to mark, most likely, things in the last days is raisers of taxes. Why? Because they're covetous. Because they love money. And so they want your money. And whether it's your money or somebody's money in Africa or whatever, they're going to be raisers of taxes. This guy, you're leading up here to a revelation of the Antichrist. Verse 20. Then shall stand up in his estate, a different guy, a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. And in his estate shall stand up a vile person. This may be a guy actually in history named Antiochus Epiphanes. And Antiochus Epiphanes came into the temple and offered a pig on the temple altar. And of course that made him a perfect type of the Antichrist. But folks, the Bible isn't just fulfilled in history. A lot of times something is fulfilled historically that still has a greater fulfillment prophetically in the future. And that's what you get into if you start dealing with folks that are saying that everything in Matthew 24 and Revelation has already happened in history. There are places you can point to it where it looks like it did kind of happen in part, but there's still a greater fulfillment yet. See, they're trying to make all those things in the past so that we can just live on out in the future without knowing what's going to happen. Because they don't like what's going to happen. Because what's testified of is that Jesus Christ is going to come down here and smash this place, and take over, and he's going to rule and reign as the Prince of Princes, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And folks, I mean, politicians do not like to hear that. The international bankers are not interested in that. And so my point is, folks, that you're reading something here that was perhaps kind of fulfilled in part in the past. You remember John the Baptist showed up just like it was prophesied? Do you remember that Elijah, he came in the spirit and power of Elijah, that Elijah has yet to show up again? There's a greater fulfillment yet in the future. Now it says here, and without getting too deep into it, verse 21, in his estate shall stand up a vile person to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. He shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, I'm kind of building to that because back in Psalm 55, verse 21, you learn something about this guy. And prophetically, he's the Antichrist. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. And so you're studying a guy here who obtains the kingdom by flatteries and comes in peaceably. That's what the Antichrist does. Verse 22, and with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Now this is the Antichrist, and he breaks the covenant with the Jews. Now there's a second person involved there. It says that this Antichrist, we know him as the Antichrist, comes in, and things shall be overflown from before him and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Who's the prince of the covenant? Well, the prince of the covenant is not Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ is not broken in the future. Right? So this is another guy. There's going to be a guy, I believe, and I find other places here. There's a guy, and we don't know who he is, as far as I know. When the Antichrist rises and makes the covenant with the Jews during Daniel's 70th week and allows the sacrifices to pick back up and to be re-imparted, there's going to be somebody else involved on the other side of the table that allows it to happen. And somewhere along the way, the prince of the covenant, that guy, is going to be taken out of the way. I mean, let me show you, where shall I go here? Look in Lamentations chapter 4 real fast. Lamentations. Right after Jeremiah. Lamentations chapter 4. Now there are some differences in how this is taught. And this has always made sense to me, so this is kind of the way I teach it until I can see it another way. But we're talking here about, okay, not only an Antichrist, we're talking not about Jesus Christ, we're talking about a person that presumably is a Jew, or at least a negotiator for the Jews, that is influential in establishing a covenant with the Antichrist. And I believe this is what it's talking about in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19. Now, this context is all tribulation. Verse 19, our persecutors are swifter than the eagles of the heaven. They pursued us upon the mountains. They laid wait for us in the wilderness. Wilderness? Right? Wilderness is where the Jews flee to, correct? Now, notice verse 20, what it says. The breath of our nostrils, the anointed of the Lord, was taken in their pits, of whom we said, under his shadow we shall live among the heathen. Now, you might be tempted to make that Christ, but I don't think that works. I know he was the anointed of the Lord, but you can make it Calvary if you want, but we're talking here in Lamentations. I think that this is a prince of the Jews that is influential anyway in making the covenant with the Antichrist that establishes for the first part of the tribulation anyway. If it's a 7-year tribulation, that's where part of the issue comes up. We'll talk more about it in a second. But this guy is eventually taken out of the way and killed. And the Jews are greatly, tragically disappointed because they thought this was a guy that could lead them. And now they're left to the throes of the Antichrist. Back to Daniel chapter 11. Just let's chase down a little bit more here. And hopefully, I just want to establish that you can see what's going on before we get back to Psalm 55. So, the Prince of the Covenant, I think it's a third party. I don't think it's Christ. I know it's not the Antichrist. It's somebody that has a part of making the covenant. And after, verse 23, after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. He shall enter peaceably. This is the Antichrist. Even upon the fattest places of the province. He shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. That seems to indicate that the Antichrist is a Jew. Now, I can take you through a whole bunch of verses, but he's probably partially a Jew. He's also called the Assyrian. A-S-S-Y. Assyrian, not A-Syrian. He's an Assyrian. He's an Assyrian Jew. So you're going to have an Antichrist rise up who is probably Jewish. And he says in verse 24, once again, he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds even for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and you can guess at who the south is. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. You wonder what that's about. They shall forecast devices against him. Verse 26, yea, they that feed the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow. Many shall fall down slain. And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end. Now, you might recognize that as something. He that endureth to the end. We're talking here about a tribulation setting. He says, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed. Then shall he return unto his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. Now that's the covenant God makes with the Jews, the holy covenant. And he shall do exploits and return to his own land. At the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter. Now, I've never figured out these movements or these details, how it works exactly. I have no predictions about how that works, but I just keep coming through and getting snagged on these things that, you know, we've been given wording for, the end and the covenant and the prince of the covenant and all those sort of things. Those things are prophesying of a future time, tribulation, with an Antichrist who makes a covenant with the Jews during the tribulation. And meanwhile, they're happily coming along for a while, sacrificing at the temple as far as we can see. And then one day, the Antichrist steps up and says, that's it, that's in. And he causes the sacrifices to cease. We'll see it in a second. Keep going here, verse 30, because it gets kind of rich here. Just remember what you've read in your New Testament as you've read. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved in return, and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. Well, folks, they have indignation against the Holy Covenant now. Boy, anytime a Jew stands up and wants to do something, you know, the slightest bit orthodox, I mean, they're kind of crazy about it. It goes on to say, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. Now, remember, part of this discussion started with this covenant that is broken back in Psalm 55. You don't have to go back there. Just look in Daniel 11, verse 31. An arm shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice. There's the sacrifice that's taken out, is established in the tribulation in the temple, the newly built temple. And they sacrifice for a while, and those sacrifices are made to cease. And they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. That's the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet in Matthew 24, right? And when you see the abomination that maketh desolate set in the holy place, then you'll get off your roof. Don't turn around and get anything and flee to the mountains, right? Get out of here. You're on the run in the wilderness from this point on with the Antichrist. Well, that abomination that maketh desolate is some sort of idolatrous placement. And if the folks that think this was only fulfilled in history make Antiochus Epiphanes the guilty party. But Antiochus Epiphanes was just the beginning. So you look down then in verse 32, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." Now, just take note, this is twice it mentions him speaking with flattery. "But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." Now, that's not you. You should know your God now. But you're not going to be in this scenario needing to know God, because you're out of here. Because you're not a Jew. And if you're saved, you ain't going through it. Verse 33, "And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days." Do you know what? Do you know how long it says that when Elijah stood up and prophesied there would be drought? It said that that there would be drought for many days, he said. You know how many days that was? 3.5 years. Many days is one of the tripping phrases in the Word of God for, in many cases, 3.5 years. We're talking here about a prophetic future. Look in 34. "Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with little help, but many shall cleave unto them with flatteries." There's flattery again. "Some of them of understanding shall fall and try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end." Again, a prophesying of the end of the tribulation. "Because it is yet for a time appointed. And the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god." Now we'll look at it in a second, but that's the Antichrist, right? "And shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods." Notice capital G God of small g gods. I mean, this guy, again, we'll look at the cross references in just a second. I'm trying to just lay out a timeline here. "And shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished," God's indignation judging Israel. "For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers." Notice that? This is the Antichrist. "Neither shall he regard the capital G God of his fathers." If the capital G God is God, his fathers are then the Jews. The Antichrist is a Jew. So, it wasn't Barak, and it's not Joe. Right? Am I putting you to sleep or what? "Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women." Oh boy. Probably means Fairyland. I think the Antichrist is a queer. Just thought I'd let you know that. They don't need to know that. There are certain advantages to coming to church. I'm not denigrating you guys. "Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all." So you see that thing we've been studying in 2 Timothy 3, you know, men shall be lovers of their own selves. You're making yourselves gods. Pretty soon you don't regard anybody but what's going on with you. That's a mark of the devil. That's the mark of the devil incarnate. All right, verse 38. "But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces." Hello, Yoda. Right? May the force be with you. He'll honor the God of forces. All the Buddhists and all of the guys that can float off the ground, you know, by sitting cross-legged, you know, they say that the force is in your navel. And that, you know, there's some way that you center on your center, and you can defy gravity. And it's real, because the devil's real. And in his estate shall he honor the god of forces, and a god whom his fathers knew not. There's his fathers again. He's a Jew. Shall he honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And in the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like whirlwind, with chariots and horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now, I'll skip the next couple or three verses. Just pick up in verse 44. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make to make away many. He shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end. This guy is going to inhabit Jerusalem like it's his, but he'll come to an end. Now, I know that that seems like a rambling thing, but what I wanted you to see with all this, if you'll go back to Psalm 55, I just wanted you to see that the Lord segued from the general wicked to talking about somebody who is going to break a covenant. We saw various times there where this holy covenant is broken by this Antichrist. So all that's prophetic. Now, look, we could go and study Daniel 8 as well, and Daniel 9 as well, but we don't do that tonight. Look down in verse 21, where, you know, again, we mentioned this before. This is what this was leading to. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. I mean, the Bible said back there that he obtains the kingdom, right? By flatteries. Let me just see if I can find you. Go back, if you will, to Daniel chapter 8, just a second. Daniel 8. And where you saw earlier that the Antichrist magnified himself above all other gods, and that he magnified himself to the prince of the host. There's two marks to his speech, his speaking. One is that he's a flatterer, so he knows how to smooth talk and oily talk everybody. On the other hand, he thinks he's God. You need to watch those two characteristics together in people. Somebody that at one point is flattering, oily, smooth-talking, but at the same time is totally self-consumed. Because I wanted to show you this self-consumption with this guy. Look in Daniel chapter 8 and notice verse. And again, there's a context here. I don't want to get too completely off the base here, but this is all talking about the Antichrist. Therefore, verse 8, just start in verse 8. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Now I know that's leaving you a little bit in the dark as far as the context, but just hang in there. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land, and it waxed great even to the host of heaven. I mean, this horn, this king, this person, this prince, waxes great even to the host of heaven. He's got some sort of connection in heaven. And it shall cast down some of the host and of the stars. You remember that Satan led an angelic host to rebellion. And Jesus said, I saw Satan fall as lightning to the earth. Okay? There's a further fulfillment of that in the tribulation. And stamped upon them in verse 10. In verse 11, yea, this is really what we're after, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. Now, who's that? Well, that's Jesus Christ. He magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him, the daily sacrifice, there it is again, was taken away and the place of his sanctuary was cast down, and an host was given him against the daily sacrifice. There's going to be demonic, devilish interaction in taking away that sacrifice. A host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Keep reading for just a second here. Then I heard one saint speaking, another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? He said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Notice again down in the end of verse 17, the time of the end. In verse 19, twice, the last end, the end. It just goes on and on. Look in verse 22. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. The Antichrist. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. This king is going to be empowered by the devil. He shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people, the Jews. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper. And that's not talking about yarn making. We're talking about craft, witchcraft. He shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace, there it is again, peace, shall he destroy many. And he shall also stand up against the prince of princes, no doubt who that is, right? He'll stand up against him, but he shall be broken without hand. So the stone comes down and smashes him at Armageddon. He's broken without hand. Now, all that is just to point out that this guy is, first of all, magnifies himself as God, as if he were God. This is a demonic attribute. Look in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. Of course, this is the fall of the devil, Lucifer. And notice verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, not star of the morning, right? How art thou cut down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, so this is what the devil said, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High, yet thou shalt be brought down to the hell, to the sides of the pit. He said, I will be like the Most High. That's the devil. That's the devil talking. Look in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and there can be no doubt here. Actually, the point to all this, I know you, I drug you through a whole bunch of stuff, but the earmarks of his talk will be peaceableness and flattery on one hand, but on the other hand, he thinks he's God. Now, you can think of some politicians that talk just like that. I mean, boy, they are smooth and oily. They're so slick, you slide off your chair just listening to them. But boy, you know, they think that they are the cat's meow. And you've seen the fall of some of them. And of course, they'll all fall. But 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and notice verse 3. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, that's the Antichrist, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. so that he as God, sitting in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So the reason the Antichrist goes in and sits down on the throne, sits down on the mercy seat apparently in the temple to in part defile the temple, is because he's establishing himself that he is God. Because it was God that sat on that mercy seat. See what I'm saying? And so that's his view of himself. And so you're reading this about, you know, in one, you know, viewpoint, practically, just wicked men. And they talk real smooth, but they are lovers of their own selves, and they actually think themselves to be gods. Years ago, now it's been years now, but walked into the doctor's office, and for one thing or other, and there's a magazine on the table, and on the front of the magazine, or the back, forget, whatever, there's the torso of this really buff guy. It's an advertisement for something. I don't even remember what the advertisement was for, but it said, "You're a god." So this really buff torso, and it said, "You're a god." Don't you tell me that that's not what's on people's minds. It is. It is. It's in the wiring. It's in the sin nature. So let's pick back up here in Psalm 55. Psalm 55, verse 20, this guy arises speaking peaceably. He breaks this covenant. We established that as the Antichrist. Some of those other verses were about his views of himself as being God. And notice verse 21 goes into the words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. And that's how things go. Look at a few places here. Well, actually, we've been through that in recent days, so we don't have to. But I mean, by good words and fair speeches, they deceive the hearts of the simple. It's they never talk like you presume the devil will talk. Let me tell you something. Never talk like that. I mean, whatever. Anyway. Verse 21, the words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. And so he goes on and says, cast thy burden upon the Lord. And we can go back to practicality here. Cast thy burden upon the Lord. Amen. 1 Peter chapter 5. Why should I? 1 Peter chapter 5. I'll give you an excellent reason to do so. 1 Peter 5:7. Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. And then notice what's the next verse. See how those two things abide so close together? Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walketh about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Okay? Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Be sober, be vigilant. You better be careful what you do with your care. You better be careful what you do with your burdens, because the devil's stalking within one verse. Right? You start turning your cares over to man. Look what we've done here. I say we collectively in broad terms, but look at what our country's done. It's turned our cares over to the government. The devil's stalking there. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking him who may devour. You should cast all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Now, notice something else here in this passage, verse 22 of Psalm 55. Let me finish this before we break tonight. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. That sounds like a promise you should cling to. That there's hours and times you're not quite sure what to do. You are burdened and you are full of care. So what do I do? Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Now, you know, it turns out that sustenance is only mentioned a handful of times in the Word of God. Look, if you will, in 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings 17. He'll sustain thee. Now, I should say when I say this that sustenance, it's not like you're going to get real fat and sloppy on it, because it's sustenance, okay? It's miraculous, but it's sustenance. We'll see that in a second. 1 Kings chapter 17, and go down, if you will, to verse 9. 1 Kings 17, 9. Oh boy, that's not the one. Yeah, it is. Arise, get thee to Zarephath. This is the prophet, and he's got a... There's famine coming on the land. It's a type of the tribulation, and so he has to go somewhere to be sustained. Verse 9. Arise, get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee. Now, you know how that story goes? He gets there, and she's cooking the last piece of bread they have, and she and her son are going to eat and die, right? Well, it turns out that the barrel of meal did not waste, and the cruse of oil did not fail, and they ate the rest of their time, oil and meal. So essentially, corn dodgers, just oil and meal. But it sustained them. Now, they didn't eat T-bone steak, but it sustained them, right? What was that lady's name that was in, say it in? Darlene Rose, exactly. Darlene Rose sustained herself on bananas when she was in prison with the Japs. Somebody came in, tossed her some bananas, and she sustained herself on bananas. She gave credit to God. Now, bananas would get pretty old unless you were really hungry. But it's better than dying. So I just want to say that, you know, if you expect sustenance to be an Escalade and, you know, T-bones and lobster tails, that's probably not it. So sustenance is fairly just essential. Look, if you will, in another place here, look in Nehemiah chapter 9. These are the places where the Bible says that God sustained somebody. Nehemiah chapter 9. I hope that we, as Americans, haven't gotten so stinking spoiled that when God supernaturally sustains us, that we think we're still getting shorted, because after all, it wasn't a string of pearls that we got. You know what I'm saying? Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 21. It's summarizing the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Yea, 40 years didst thou sustain them in the wilderness. With what? Mostly manna. They died with a bunch of quail in their bellies, so that was a curse. But mainly with manna and water, right? The animals would have provided them some other protein, presumably, and milk and stuff, I suppose. But mainly manna and water. But notice in verse 21, so that they lacked nothing. So you can be down pretty close to bare and still lack nothing. Having food and raiment, let us be there with content. Those are almost foreign words to Americans. And look, I don't have a death wish. I don't want to have to just live on food and on bread and water. But I realize that maybe there comes a time where we don't have it as easy as we've had it. It may be just sustenance. And God will still be good. In fact, it'll be miraculous. This verse. So that they lacked nothing. Their clothes waxed not old, and their feet swelled not. Tell me, how did so many of the Jews make it through the Nazi camps alive? You know, we've all seen the corded up stacks of naked, emaciated bodies, you know, in the Nazi, you know, trenches and stuff like that. But there were still a lot that escaped. How'd that happen? It's the Lord leaving Himself a remnant. And it was a miracle that they did. Right? Sustenance. Sustenance. There's just another verse or two here, and then I'll be done tonight. Look, if you will, in Psalm 3. You should think about this one. This is a reality in your life every day. Psalms chapter 3. You think the Lord is really interested in you getting through this? By this, I mean whatever you're going through. I mean, you think the Lord is really interested in miraculously sustaining you? I'd say yes. Because the fact of the matter is that He does every day anyway. Psalms 3, verse 4. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and He heard me out of His holy hill, Selah. I laid me down and slept. I waked, for the Lord sustained me. Sustenance. He sustains you by letting you wake up. No reason you should wake up. You know, man, we got home last night. We were just flat wore out. I looked at Marcy and she said, "What time?" I said, "What time?" And she said, 8:30. I said, "It feels like it's 1:30 in the morning." We went to bed. Man, I slept hard. And you know, you sleep hard like that, and you know, you conk out. You're not conscious. You know, the Lord controls your breathing. Why should you wake up? People in comas are essentially in the same condition. They just don't wake up. Why should you wake up out from your nap? Because the Lord sustains you. It doesn't make sense that you should conk and that most of us every day just wake back up and just go right on with our lives. Because the Lord sustains you. All right? All right, that's enough for tonight. We need to close, I suppose. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, I thank You.